Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The ongoing battle over immigration and the fate of so-called dreamers brought to the U.S. as children can be felt on the Delaware State University campus, where some dreamers are lobbying Congress to strike a deal.
So I think for them it's a very eye-opening experience when they sit down with us and they realize that we're, you know, no different from their grandchildren or we're no different from their children.
We sit down with a dreamer at DSU to learn her story and perspective on the immigration debate. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also check in on the future of the Delaware City Refinery and examine the impact making more beds available for treatment could have on the opioid crisis. Plus, we learn about a popular Wilmington music festival expanding downstate and introduce you to a podcast trying to humanize politicians. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this month, Philadelphia Energy Solutions, which operates the East Coast's largest refinery complex in South Philadelphia, filed for bankruptcy. That move has some at PFB Energy's Delaware City Refinery raising red flags, saying the primary issue causing Philadelphia Energy Solutions' financial woes is also a problem for the First State Refinery. That issue is federally mandated renewable fuel credits the refineries need to purchase, called Renewable Identification Numbers, or RINs. What are these credits? And are they really causing dark financial clouds to gather over Delaware City? Contributor John Hurdle delved into this issue for us. His piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to discuss what he found. Well, first off, can you give us a kind of thumbnail sketch of what these renewable identification numbers, or RINs, are and how they work?
Well, they are a mechanism that the federal government has set up in order to force producers like Delaware City Refinery to ensure that the specific quantities of renewable fuels are being produced. This all stems from something called the Energy Policy Act of 2005. So companies like Delaware City Refinery that can comply with this renewable fuels standard, either by producing the actual fuels like ethanol, or else by buying credits. Now, Delaware City Refinery sells unblended gasoline to distributors. It doesn't produce its own ethanol, so therefore it's got to buy these so-called RINs from other producers that actually do generate those things.
And so what's the issue been for refineries like Philadelphia Energy Solutions, which just declared bankruptcy, and PBF's Delaware City Refinery with these RINs?
The issue is that the RINs are hugely expensive, Delaware City Refinery says that they're spending between $75 and $85 million a year. They've been doing that since 2014 as a result of the very sharp inflation in the price of these RINs. And the reason for that is these tools are traded on a secondary market, and they're subject to speculation, which in turn is driven by what the market thinks the Environmental Protection Agency is going to do, what their policy is going to be going forward. And so all of this has driven the price of RINs to many, many times higher than they were when they first started trading. For a number of years, they were just trading at around about 5 cents each, and they went up as high as 1.45 each in 2013, and they're now back down to around about 65 cents. But that's obviously very much higher than they were originally, and that that companies like Delaware City Refinery were used to dealing with.
You mentioned that the cost that Delaware City Refinery is incurring right now. How big an issue is this, if you put that in perspective, for the refinery right now and going forward?
Well, I think that they will tell you that it's really a huge issue. The Delaware City Refinery has been playing this card very prominently for quite a long time now, but the recent bankruptcy filing by Philadelphia Energy Solutions, which is a much bigger operation than Delaware City, the bankruptcy filing last month is being used by Delaware City as an indication of what might happen to them. And so, you know, what the folks at Delaware City will tell you is that they are, I guess, rattling all the cages they possibly can at both state and federal levels to try to get some relief for this from the EPA.
And what is the relief they're seeking from EPA?
Well, you know, it's not clear what the specific policy actions are that they're seeking, but what is clear is that it's the PBF will say that this is their by far their biggest priority in terms of their representations to the federal government. They say that they've had conversations not only with the Trump administration but also with the Obama administration, with the EPA itself, and they're hoping that they're going to get some relief as a result of representations by the Delaware congressional delegation.
I was going to say, you mentioned they were rattling cages, and locally that has included the local political leadership and the Delaware congressional delegation, correct?
That's correct, yes. I'm told that the governor has recently written to the EPA Administrator Pruitt on this. There's also been representations by Senators Carper and Coons and Representative Blunt Rochester to the Federal Trade Commission, alleging or asking that body to look into this market trading of RINs, which PBF says is actually fraudulent.
And what's the argument for these credits and keeping them in place as is?
Well, the original idea was to reduce the amount of fossil fuels that gets burned in transportation fuels, in heating oil, and in jet fuel. And the system was set up by the federal government to allow the government to monitor the actual use of ethanol, and so these RINs are actually a specific number is assigned for every gallon of ethanol that's produced. I guess the other argument that's used in favor of them of these RINs, and this is, I guess, not surprising, it comes from renewable fuel producers, such as, you know, corn-growing regions like Iowa. And, of course, they support any measure that would increase the production of those fuels.
Any indication what EPA may do here?
Not so far. The Delaware City Refinery says that EPA was considering some relief last year, but has now rolled back on that, and they've put in place what PBF refers to as an overly aggressive renewable fuel standard for this year. They're saying that PBF, that is saying that this is, again, because of pressure from the renewable fuel lobby.
And the Delaware City Refinery, John, also recently suffered another setback in court. Can you quick tell us about that and the potential impact there?
Yeah, well, this is kind of a separate issue in that for a couple of years now, the Delaware Refinery has been seeking permission to set up to increase its so-called transshipment operation of ethanol to other East Coast refineries. And what that means is that they would have what they would like to do is to store and ship about five times the amount of ethanol that they currently do to these other refineries. A couple of environmental groups are saying that the plan violates the Coastal Zone Act. A state board recently refused to hear that the group's appeal against that. But this goes to the setback that the refinery has had. A state judge recently basically sent the case back to the board for another hearing on whether these environmental groups have standing to bring their case. So I think what we can conclude from all that is that, you know, this is one more setback, albeit a procedural thing, in the refinery's efforts to expand that operation.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for joining us on The Green this week. Again, you can find his full story on how these federally mandated renewable fuel credits could impact Delaware City Refinery's future right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We'll hear from a dreamer at Delaware State University about the ongoing fight over DACA and immigration, and examine one piece of the battle to combat the opioid crisis here in the first state. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Immigration remains a front burner issue. President Trump spent a fair amount of his State of the Union address earlier this week laying out how he wants to tackle it. But for some, this heated policy debate is very personal. Delaware State University sophomore Dulce Guerrero wakes up every day scared and stressed out. She's what some people call a dreamer, an undocumented resident who was brought to the U.S. as a child, in her case, when she was 2 years old. She's currently protected from deportation by the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. But President Trump is ending DACA and gave Congress a March 5th deadline to find a solution on what to do with dreamers. Guerrero recently sat down with Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller to discuss her status and the current political battle, including the recent federal government shutdown, which failed to produce an agreement to protect dreamers from deportation.
What is your work permit status?
So I currently have DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And with that, I'm able to obtain a work permit and I'm able to obtain a driver's license to be able to drive legally in the United States.
And when does it expire?
Mine expires in the fall of 2019. So I renewed it recently and I was able to get it until 2019.
So with everything that's going on, I mean, what do you think about everything that's happening?
Right. I mean, I think it's a, you know, very unfortunate situation for a lot of us who are currently covered under DACA. I think there's definitely this certain sense of uncertainty of not knowing what's going to happen in the future, whether, you know, we're going to continue to be able to stay here, whether there's going to be an actual deadline for us to exit. So I think it's definitely frustrating. It's stressful, especially trying to do school and then trying to juggle what's going on in D.C. But I think at the end of the day, like, something positive is going to happen. You know, we definitely want to remain optimistic about, you know, it being an unfortunate situation. But hopefully out of all of this, something can happen that is permanent, something that we've been waiting on for a very, very long time.
So what age did you come here and where did you come from?
So I came to the United States at the age of 2 and I came from Mexico. My family came to the United States and we settled in the state of Georgia, which is where I lived for about 20 years prior to coming to Delaware.
Why did your parents decide to come here?
So initially, my parents decided to come here, obviously, because they wanted to give my brother and I a better life. My brother is older than me, so they definitely wanted to bring us here in order to be able to get a better education. My parents back home, they were not making as much money as they needed to in order to support my brother and I. So definitely, I think they just wanted to give us a better future and wanted us to thrive. They wanted us to be able to go to college. They wanted us to be able to have a successful life. So I think that was the biggest reason, was definitely us. Their children.
Do you know people who have been deported?
Yes, I do. I know plenty of people, countless people. I had an aunt and an uncle who were deported for driving without a license in the state of Georgia. So just, you know, once again, the level of hostility towards immigrants in the South and the way that anti-immigrant laws are written in the South are completely different. Because I know that here in Delaware, like, even if you're undocumented, you get some type of, like, driver's permit. In the state of Georgia, unfortunately, we don't have that. So something as simple as driving without a license could cause someone to be deported. I know another member that, you know, a student who went to school with me in high school, and he was actually the victim of a drunk driver. So he was hit by a drunk driver. And when the police showed up, they arrested him for driving without a license, and he ended up being deported. He graduated top of his class, and he was deported before the DACA announcement was released. So he was not able to qualify for it. So he's currently living back in Mexico. So we definitely know a lot of people who have been deported even before the DACA program. And, you know, through the years of 2008 to 2016, through the Obama administration, there was a lot of enforcement. And a lot of people, I guess, don't know or maybe don't acknowledge that President Obama did deport more people than any other president in history. And he has his record. And that's why they call him the deporter-in-chief. So definitely, like, we lived through that era and we know what enforcement feels like. We know what deportation feels like. And we've lived it firsthand.
So I want to go up to the shutdown. How do you think the Democrats handled that?
In terms of the shutdown, I mean, I think that having the government shut down is not productive for anyone because there's not really much going on, right? There's not like this sitting down and this negotiating, especially because I think it pushes a lot of the Republicans to want to work with the Democrats in order to find a solution. And at the end of the day, like, we need a solution and we need both parties to sit down and be willing to negotiate. I think that, you know, it happened kind of as a sign to the Republicans that there needs to be a solution and the Democrats are able to withhold their vote once again on February 8th. So we're hoping that come February 8th, you know, both parties are able to come together. There's able to be some type of legislation that's actually voted on so it doesn't cause this again. Because we feel like if there is another shutdown, the only thing that it does, it delays the process and it pushes us forward to the March 5th deadline, which is something that we definitely don't want to hit.
So you guys have been lobbying instead of protesting. Mm-hmm. And so can you talk about why you made that decision?
Yeah, for sure. So we've definitely, like, I myself have been involved in immigrants' rights for 5-6 years, and we've done a lot of the protesting. Like, I've been arrested in civil disobedience, so we know, like, what protesting is like, and it's not something that we're afraid of. This time around, we realized that, you know, because of the administration that we had, we needed to go inside and have these conversations, have the difficult conversations, and sit down with Republican members and ask them, like, what's it going to take for you to support a bill? Right now, we know that the Republicans control all three chambers. They control the Senate, they control the House, and then we have Donald Trump as the president, a man who, you know, built his campaign and won with this promise of building a wall. So we definitely agreed that we needed to go and have these difficult conversations with a lot of the Republicans as well as the Democrats and try to find where the middle ground is, because we're definitely going to need it. We're going to need to have a compromise. We're going to need to have strategic negotiations, and we're going to need to pass something soon. So that's why this time around we opted to go and to lobby and to visit the members of Congress. And so far we've done, I think it's like 5 or 6 trips to D.C. already since DACA was rescinded. And we've been able to visit over 200 offices. So we've been able to meet with actual senators, with actual representatives on both sides of the aisle, and really share our stories and talk about why this is so important and why they should not walk away from the negotiating table and how it's so crucial to find a solution soon. And, you know, the deadline of March 5th is coming up. So we've definitely, you know, opted for that route this time around.
And so what are the Republicans that you've met with, you know, what do they say?
So I think a lot of the Republicans that we've met with, it's actually their first time meeting someone who's undocumented. So I think for them, it's a very eye-opening experience when they sit down with us and they realize that we're, you know, no different from their grandchildren, or we're no different from their children, or we've gone to schools at places where, you know, they have family members. So I think it's definitely a very big eye-opening experience for them. And the feedback that we've gotten from the Republicans is that they also want to solve the issue. They just have a different way of seeing things. And they definitely want to make sure that the border is secure. They definitely want to make sure that there's more technology allocated to the border, so on and so forth. So, again, we're having these conversations with people who may disagree with us, and we're trying to find common ground with them because we know that it's necessary. And I think that, for the most part, yeah, the Republicans have understand that there needs to be a solution, and they're trying to figure out what the proposals are going to look like. But I think they definitely see things from a different point of view. So meeting with us and listening to our stories of how enforcement affects us, or why we think certain things should be taken out, or why we think certain things should be added, I think it definitely gives them a more real-life perspective, and it kind of puts a human face to the issue. So as opposed to them just voting on a bill or just seeing numbers floating around, like, it's, you know, they remember it's a real-life human person behind all these bills that they're voting on.
So how do you approach the March 5th deadline? I mean, do you wake up and think, you know, today is January 26th? Mm-hmm. What goes through your head? You know, what do you feel?
I think definitely, like, it's scary every day, and it's really stressful, honestly, waking up every morning and having to deal with class, having to deal with this and that, and then on top of that, like, dealing with the fact that you might not be here pretty soon. So I think it's definitely stressful. It's a stressful time for many of us just to wake up every day and not know that. But I think at the end of the day, there's also this sense of hope at the end of the day, because we know that come the March 5th deadline, there's going to be a decision. We're either going to be able to adjust our status permanently, which is something that we've been waiting on for over 16 years, or we're going to be potentially, you know, in danger of deportation. So there's no middle ground on this. It's either going to be a really good result, or it's either going to be a really bad one. Like, there's no middle ground on it. And I think, you know, we try to remain optimistic, and this kind of hope that it will be something that is positive is kind of what also keeps us going. So as opposed to focusing on the negative and focusing on, you know, we might be deported by March 5th, we kind of try to focus on, like, hey, we might have a pathway to citizenship come March 5th. And I think that's kind of what keeps a lot of us going, and a lot of us feeling a little bit more optimistic about continuing going to D.C. and, you know, talking to congressmen and lobbying them.
Thanks to DSU student Dulce Guerrero and our Sarah Mueller for their time on The Green this week. Now we turn to another issue very much in the headlines, the opioid crisis. 308 people in Delaware died from overdoses in 2016. And when the remaining toxicology reports come in for 2017, it's likely the number of opioid overdose deaths last year will surpass that 2016 total. As lawmakers and medical experts statewide seek to stem that upward trend, one issue that arises is the availability of beds for people who want help getting clean. Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino has more on the debate surrounding sober living and inpatient treatment beds for people struggling with opioid addiction.
There are about 11,000 people in Delaware suffering from opioid addiction and just over 100 beds for treatment.
Both those numbers and our conversations with people out in the field suggest that that's not adequate.
That's Attorney General Matt Den. He says he wants to see state funds used to make more beds available, beds for people who want to enroll in a program that will help them quit using opioids. But some health experts say adding more beds is not the best approach. They argue some shorter-term inpatient programs put patients at a high risk for overdose when they leave, because their tolerance for the drugs is lowered during that period of sobriety. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is co-director of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative at Brandeis University. He says detox and rehab are not usually effective modes of treatment for opioid addiction.
The most effective treatments are long-term outpatient treatments with a medicine like buprenorphine.
And Delaware Department of Health and Social Services Secretary Dr. Kara Odom Walker points out there are often vacancies for inpatient treatment.
Most of the time when people reach out to us and say, I can't find a bed, it's often that we need to work with their insurance coverage to figure out how to get them into a place.
It's important to note that every addiction case is unique, and since there is no standard for care when treating an opioid addict, different facilities will have different models for treatment. When people talk about beds for opioid addiction, they are often lumping together these different models. First, there are detox centers, specifically designed to treat addiction withdrawal management in the short term. People usually only stay for a few days. Workers at the Connections Detox in Harrington say the center is always very busy, but they've never seen anyone denied care because of overcapacity. Another model is inpatient treatment centers. These programs usually last about 20 to 30 days, provide counseling, and do not have a waiting list to get in. Lori Dyer is the program director for Gateway Foundation in Smyrna. She says patients who want to continue treatment after their time is up will be referred to a sober living facility.
We won't put our clients out on the street. We have a safe discharge plan for our clients. They always will go somewhere safe unless they choose to leave against staff advice.
And then there are sober living homes, recovering addicts living together in a home or apartment setting, participating in group therapy, and being monitored by staff members. These are the ones that always have a waiting list.
How you doing?
Fine. My name's Nick Shalino. I'm with Delaware Public Media.
I'm Jason.
Good to meet you, Jason.
You too.
Jason O'Connor was a resident at the Connection Sober Living Home in Harrington last year. He has gone through the program and has since moved out on his own. He says when he got out of detox, he was put on a waiting list before being admitted into the sober living home and had to get by without a place of his own in the meantime.
The first time I came here, there was a 30-day wait, but it wound up being about 2 weeks, so I didn't have to, it was a relatively warm October, so it wasn't that bad, but I stayed outside a couple times and it wasn't too bad.
But not all patients in Delaware are forced to wait outside for a vacancy to open up at a sober living home. Christine Greeley is living at one of the Lyman House sober living homes in Wilmington. She says after detox, she was able to stay at the Gaudenzia Inpatient Treatment Center while she waited to get in.
I was there for about a month and a week waiting to get into here. But even though there's a waiting list, Gaudenzia will approve your insurance until you get into a facility.
Both Greeley and O'Connor say that sober living homes have been able to help them. But part of the problem is not all people addicted to opioids are seeking treatment. Kathy McKay is the CEO at Connections. She says she has seen people overdose outside of a detox center, be brought back to life with naloxone, and still refuse to go inside for treatment.
We had a case the other day at one of our clinics where somebody who is a client there brought somebody who's not a client. The guy was blue. He was dead. The nurses ran out there with some Narcan. They brought him back to life. He wouldn't come in.
Physicians say it's a challenge to find reachable moments when opioid addicts are willing to submit themselves to care. Attorney General Matt Den says funding more beds with a wide spectrum of treatment options will increase accessibility and make it more likely people will be reached at those critical moments.
You get a relatively narrow window with some people where they are willing to go into treatment. And when that window opens, then you need to have the type of treatment that, that will help them, that makes sense to them, that is geographically sensible for them, that's, you know, in some proximity to their family and their work.
Den says he is working with lawmakers to propose earmarking $4 million this year to put towards more beds. He says if the measure is passed, officials from the newly created Behavioral Health Consortium will decide the treatment model for the additional beds. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Nick Schellino.
Thanks, Nick. And stay with us. The Green continues with our arts playlist and the downstate expansion of the popular Ladybug Music Festival. That's right after we check in on your local news headlines here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Since 2012, the Ladybug Music Festival in Wilmington has been putting the spotlight on women's music, with a free block party that's grown from 20 acts and 300 attendees in its first year to 75 acts and 10,000 attendees over 2 days in 2017. Now organizers are trying to extend Ladybug's reach downstate, announcing this week they'll be bringing another version of the event to Milford this September. For this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chatted with Ladybug's organizers at Gable Music Ventures, CEO Gail Dillman, and President and Chief Operating Officer Jeremy Hebel about the event's expansion downstate.
We're talking about the inaugural Milford Ladybug Music Festival. Give us all the great news.
We're so excited. This will be the first time that we move the event to a different location other than downtown Wilmington. Being a woman in the music business, as we all know, it's a pretty male-dominated business, and the Ladybug Music Festival is a celebration of women in music. So to be able to bring it to another location within the state is really, really exciting for us. Many, many music festivals are very male dominated. They're great. Music is wonderful. But for instance, Firefly, less than 20% of their lineup are women. So we are excited to be able to bring an all-female cast down to the Milford area, Milford, the town, the city of Milford, and we think it's going to be great.
All right. So this started, you mentioned, back in Wilmington in 2012.
Yep.
Now you're expanding to the city of Milford. How did you choose Milford with all the cities and towns out there? Why Milford?
Milford was just a happy moment when Jeremy and I were driving down to the southern part of Delaware, and we decided to take a detour and just say, hey, I want to go check this out. And we drove into the main street, and we both like basically stopped there and just said, this is an amazing street. This is an amazing place. We went into a couple of businesses, and we were talking to them about what goes on down there. And each one of them kept saying, you've got to go talk to this one. You've got to go talk to this one. And we ended up at Gallery 37 speaking with Marsha Pickerel about music and events and what they do in the town and how much they would love to do something fresh and innovative. And that's how the whole conversation got started, just we want to get off the road and just see what Milford was all about. And that's what happened. Now we're having a festival.
Okay, so the event is planned for Saturday, September 22nd. Talk about first some of the past acts that have performed over the years when you were hosting this in Wilmington, and then let's talk about the lineup for this year in Milford.
Some of the past acts that we've had are Larkin Poe, Caroline Rose, we had Mary Lambert. These were all headlining acts in the Wilmington area. We have bands that come as far as New York City from Washington, D.C. We had one from Canada this past year. They sort of come from all over now. This year, we're also hoping to attract a very, very diverse group of women, as well as reaching out into the state of Delaware, the local music scene as well. We have not, lined up everyone for September, so we're not releasing a lineup quite yet. That will be probably in the later summer.
Okay. The Ladybug Music Festival, how did you come up with that name? Did you know that the ladybug was the state bug for Delaware when you came up with that name?
No. So Ladybug started in 2012. We were asked to do a small block party on the 2nd and Market Street area in Wilmington. And it was right when Firefly was announced. And everybody was kind of upset. There were no local bands on it. And we decided, oh, well, let's do something different. Let's see if we can get that whole audience that's going to go to Firefly to stop in Wilmington. We'll do a completely local event. And let's see, we've got to name it a bug. Oh, we'll name it Ladybug. And it'll be all about women. I didn't even know it was the state bug until I think the day of the event or shortly before it, where somebody had said to us, you know, this is the state bug of Delaware. And it was a very, very happy accident. It was like, oh, that's great.
All right, let's bring Jeremy in. Let's switch gears a little bit, Jeremy.
Sure.
Besides this being a huge arts boom to the area, obviously, the primary goal is to assist in the revitalization, really, of Milford, right?
Absolutely. And that's why we, instead of just, you know, constructing outdoor stages only for this event, we really hope that as many of the storefronts and shops that would like to participate will actually host artists and kind of turn into little mini venues for the evening, specifically to drive potential customers into those businesses. And we've seen in Wilmington, you know, when we first did the event on the third Thursday in July, which is typically a ghost town, you know, down in Wilmington, we had businesses saying that they did, you know, three times what they would typically have done on the best night of the year, on that really slow night. And so we see this real tangible result in people that, you know, when they're coming to an event that free to attend, well, then they're looking to support, you know, what's going on. So they come with money. They want to support not only the shops and the businesses that are participating, but also the musicians that are performing do really well with merchandise sales and, you know, really make really strong fans at these events as well.
Okay, so this is going to be a one-day event on Saturday, September 22nd. Give me the layout, like, because you mentioned some of the storefronts will be serving as venues for the performers. So kind of give me the layout. What area of Milford are the main stages going to be at? And
sure. It's going to be primarily concentrated on Walnut Street, really, where, you know, right, you know, where the Mispillion kind of crosses over, where the Riverfront Theater is. You've got that little beautiful little amphitheater that's outside there. Our plan, you know, it's still early in the process, so I don't want to specifically commit to where the main stages are going to be, but that's going to be the concentration of the event, is that main Walnut Street area is going to be closed down to traffic. We're going to avoid trying to close down too many roads. We don't want this to be a major inconvenience for the city, so we're going to have extensive talks and plans about the responsible ways to do that and make sure everybody knows when those are going to be happening, of course. But yeah, primarily on Walnut Street and the businesses that are along Walnut Street for this first year, but we, you know, see a lot of potential for growth in Milford over time, which is also one of the main reasons that we got so excited when we first started having these conversations with you know, whether it be the mayor or some of the other people we're talking to. There seemed this real immediate kind of connection between us and them that they wanted to see this not just happen once, but happen once successfully and grow. And we're really excited about that idea.
All right, so Jeremy, people hear this big announcement that the Ladybug Music Festival, the inaugural event coming to Milford this year. Of course, immediately they want to know the lineup. When are you guys going to release the full lineup? And then once that happens, how can people get tickets?
You bet. Well, the best thing about the Ladybug Festival is that it is free to attend completely. There is no ticket. And that was, again, one of the main inspirations for this event was actually the cost of Firefly Festival and how many people seemed disappointed that they wouldn't be able to attend because of those ticket prices. And we wanted to create something that literally anybody, any human being could attend regardless of the situation they were in. And so it is going to be completely free to attend. That's because there's going to be a lot of local businesses and other sponsors, corporate sponsors that come together to fund the event. But the actual physical lineup, we will commit that the lineup for the Milford event will be announced before the Wilmington event, obviously. And the Wilmington event this year is July 20th and 21st. So at least by July 20th, the full lineup will be announced.
Anything else, Jeremy or Gail, that I'm leaving out?
Well, we are really, really, again, going back to the revitalization of Milford. Anytime you put on a large event, there's going to be a lot of things we need, whether it be local artisans, artists, printers, a variety of things. And we're going to be looking to give the businesses in Milford that business. So we're hoping that money that is spent stays spent as much as possible in Milford. We are going to be searching for local talent. So if there are local female artists, we absolutely want to be pointed in their direction and hope that they get in touch with us. We do take submissions. So artists go to our website and submit for consideration to a Wilmington event. And we are going to consider any of the artists that have already submitted, which are well over 100 artists from all over the country already, to the Wilmington event. We're considering them having submitted to the Milford event at this point as well. So we're going to be pulling from that pool of talent from the much larger Wilmington event already. So we're really excited to introduce some artists to you know, a different part of Delaware that many of them probably don't know exists. And we just know people are going to fall in love with it when they get there.
Great. Gail Dillman, Jeremy Hebel, both with Gable Music Ventures, announcing the inaugural Ladybug Music Festival. This is going to be great. I'm excited about this, and we hope that everybody will be excited. And I think the best part about this is not only is it going to be celebrating women in music, but the entire thing is free.
Free to attend. You bet. Oh, you know what? Gail just had one last thing that we really want to stress as well, and sure. That is that this is all ages. We actually typically, especially in Wilmington, last year in 2017, we had an artist that was only 12 years old that was a performer. And so we really embrace kind of this upcoming talent locally, and we want to give them a stage and a platform. And we want to make sure that families know that you can bring your young children out. There's not going to be any entertainment at the festival that would not be appropriate for that.
Thanks to Gable Music Ventures CEO Gail Dillman and its president and COO Jeremy Hebel and R. Kelly Steele for their time in this week's Arts Playlist. And stay with us. We wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we meet the man behind a podcast that seeks to bring a different perspective to politics and politicians. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In a political climate that has become increasingly fractured and divisive, politicians at times seem more like partisan caricatures rather than public servants. But a former state Senate candidate here in the First State is trying to get beyond the rhetoric to learn more about the people holding political office around the country, telling their stories rather than delving into their positions on policy. Last fall, James Spadola, an Iraq war vet and former Newark policeman, launched the podcast Elected Officials of America, with the goal of interviewing lawmakers, largely unheralded ones, in all 50 states, about why they pursued politics and the adversity many overcame to reach public office. In this week's Enlighten Me, I sat down with James Spadola to chat about his podcast. What was the inspiration for your podcast?
Tom, first off, thanks for having me. Great to be chatting with you. So I ran for state senate in 2016, and it was a great experience meeting a lot of people. And I found that the misconceptions I had about politics were that, it was something just for the anointed. It was just for the high and mighty. And from, meeting elected officials during the course of the campaign and my time as a police officer, I saw that they're just human beings like us at the end of the day. And I also saw that there's a major need for people not involved in politics to get involved. So it's not even necessarily young people, which of course is helpful, but just people that aren't retreads, as some might unaffectionately refer to them, just people outside the system coming in, because that, politics is a market like anything else, and it demands competition. Democracy demands competitive elections. And to have that, we have to have engaged folks running for office. And so this podcast really, one of the main goals being to inspire people for office by breaking down the story of a politician, an elected official, generally an underdog that overcame great challenges and also personal adversities a lot of the times, just so people can see that they're a relatable human being. During my time as a police officer, I tried to humanize police officers, and as now I'm trying to humanize politicians, and I think it's harder to humanize politicians, actually, than it is police officers, but that's the inspiration.
Do you feel like the country needs a more grassroots approach to politics, that it's become too top down?
Yeah. I think there's so much, if you look at the discord and the bitterness in the air, on the campaign trail, voters just want they don't want a staunch Republican generally. They don't want a staunch Democrat. They want somebody who, is going to listen to people and is not going into something with such a fixed mindset. And, I ran in a district that's, I was, as a moderate Republican, I was outregistered 3-1. And what I would hear from Democrats, from could be staunch Democrats as voters, they still want a viable Republican Party just as balance to their Democratic elected officials. And I think that is, you know, that is something we need, especially if you just focus on Delaware. You have to have two viable political parties. And, you know, Democrats will vote for a good Republican, as, you know, as history shows. One, if they like the person. And two, you know, they want the competition. They want their own elected officials that they support to at least have that check and balance.
One of those Republicans that Democrats did vote for was former Governor and Congressman Mike Castle. He was the first person you interviewed for this podcast. And he certainly is a very recognizable name. But otherwise, you've really focused on talking to more local level politicians. What was the idea behind that? Focusing more on not necessarily the big names that people recognize, but just politicians that are kind of, you know, that day-to-day person who's entered politics.
Sure. It's twofold. First and foremost, you know, at the levels that I've been reaching out to, especially in other states, generally state senate or state house, one, they're more inclined to say yes. You know, unless I turn into Larry King, I'm gonna have a hard time just reaching out to a congressman in Texas and saying, hey, can we chat for an hour? But two is that's generally where people are going to start. If they're thinking about running for office, you generally don't wake up one morning and say, hey, I'm going to run for U.S. Senate. You might get involved with your local party, and it's going to be the most local office that, you know, because if people don't have a city council, state rep might be the first office they run for. So that's the other main reason.
You also tend to stay away, as I think you mentioned, from policy, and you're focusing more on the individual, their story. Do you see that also as an issue that we tend to define our politicians now more by platform and policy rather than the person themselves? And does that make it easier for people maybe to demonize rather than compromise?
Absolutely. You know, one of the countless themes or consistencies that I hear from the elected officials I'm talking about is, you know, we need to get to know each other as people first. You know, I think one of the best quotes came from Senator Dan Feltes, the youngest state senator for New Hampshire, who actually quoted Joe Biden when he spoke at UNH Law School. But you can't ascribe motives to what somebody is thinking. You know, you shouldn't. If you think somebody is proposing legislation that will hurt low-income people or low-wealth people, don't say it's because they hate poor people. You know, talk about you're doing something that will adversely impact low-income folks. And I think, you know, so I'm in Leadership Delaware this year, and hopefully I'm not giving away any trade secrets. But one of the things we did to start off was we spoke about a time that was transformational to us. And what it really did, I think, is just show the humanity in all of us. You know, it's hard to demonize somebody when they were just crying their eyes out to you about a very personal story. So I think if we get to know each other as people first and realize that ideally that if they're a good intention people, you focus on the disagreement and then have a drink after, you know, dust each other off and patch things up. And this way you can work together on another issue that you might agree on.
Were there some other common threads that you found in the interviews you've done so far?
Absolutely. I think everybody has struggles with time management. It's one thing when you're on the campaign trail or prior to that. You know, you're going to meetings, you can devote yourself to the whole meeting. And then once you're in office, you know, you might have three meetings that you're trying to be at. And, you know, the people in the meeting, they're like, look at this guy showing up 10 minutes late, giving a 10-minute speech and heading home. But really, you know, they're off to another event or something along those lines. And also the resistance people get from the party. If somebody has not paid enough tolls through the party, they're generally not going to get endorsed. But if you push back against that, the party will come around. So two examples off the top of my head. I spoke with David O, the first Asian American elected to Philadelphia City Council. And so he ran for city council and lost twice. And on his third time, this actually happened on his second time, but the party knew that he was going to run regardless of whether or not they endorsed him. So they endorsed him just to make it look like they had some say in the matter. Because if they didn't endorse him, it might look like they have no power. And so political parties, they like to, you know, it's more about the the misconception, and you know, they want people to go through that toll to meet with the party leader and get their blessing to run. And then I think about Joel Jones, the youngest state rep. He was elected when he was 22 in Michigan. He said something very, very insightful. So I asked him, he was basically selected by the party. And I said, that's very forward thinking of the party to select someone so young. I'm shocked they would do that. And he said, well, it was more like, I did it and then I injected that philosophy into the party. So it's something like he kind of like brought it to them and they're like, oh yeah, this is a good narrative, a young person. They might not have realized how much I think he will help the party in Michigan.
So your goal is to talk to at least one elected official in each state. You know, how far along are you in that process? You've gotten pretty far, it seems.
Yeah. So I've not every episode is up at my website, electedofficialsofamerica.com, just yet. But I've gone to 18 states. So that's by my poor math, it's just over 30% of the country. So hopefully we'll get to halfway soon. I had to slow down just a little. I'm helping a Philly nonprofit expand into Delaware, Coded by Kids. So that's taken up some time, which has been a great experience so far. But so what I'm focusing up more on now is when I said, like, I was in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho 2 weeks ago, and I knocked out three states in 4 days. Granted, it was 20 hours of driving, 10 hours in a plane, but that's probably where I'm gravitating towards now that my time management is being tested.
Surely, but surely you will get there eventually.
Absolutely, yeah. It's one of those. Had I not run for office, I wouldn't have realized this is something that's feasible. But, I think just the fact that I'm able to do this shows how accessible our elected officials are across the country. I mean, I am nothing to nobody in California. But, people are more than willing to donate an hour of their time to chat with me.
Speaking of running for office, you ran, as we mentioned, for state senate here in Delaware in 2016, lost against the incumbent in that district, Harris McDowell, though you outperformed previous Republican challengers in that district. How has this podcast influenced your thoughts on running again for something?
Well, I can't give you the farm, Tom. But, I think I didn't do this to come up with, if you listen to the podcast, we're not going into campaign strategy or anything like that, but I think it really just, it impresses upon me even more the need to work together, as trite as that might sound, and to focus on issues that matter for the people you're representing and not to get lost up in what's going on in Washington or just get sucked into that vortex of negativity, no matter what side you're on. And I think that the more our elected officials and voters just focus on our legislators as people, and they do that as well, I think we can move forward.
Thanks to James Spadola of the podcast Elected Officials of America for enlightening us this week. You can find this podcast at electedofficialsofamerica.com or on iTunes or Stitcher. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head over to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sarah Mueller, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.